Hi everyone, welcome to the second part of our three-part series focused on working with families you encounter who are navigating the asylum process, are currently undocumented, or have mixed documentation status within the family. In our first episode, we started things off with an overview of what's currently happening in Minnesota, and an example of effective collaboration and knowledge from the field, from school staff and county workers in Hennepin County. I really recommend starting there if you haven't. It's a hopeful story. It gives a lot of food for thought regarding cross-sector collaboration, which will be a theme that comes up again and again in this series, and working together to provide the types of support we know as social workers is most impactful. They were some fun conversations, and it's a great place to start in thinking about families and individuals you might encounter for whom this is relevant and who will likely increasingly interact with social workers as a result of some of the local changes we're seeing in the state of Minnesota. For today, we're going to take a deeper dive into trying to understand the process of asylum. I was so lucky to have an expert talk with me on this topic. Her name is Sarah Brennis. She has a ton of experience in this arena, which I will let her explain to you. Sarah has seen a lot of families and individuals move through this process. We had a great conversation about that experience and what it can look like, some of the history of how our system is set up, the things that make it unique, some more recent history, and the current changes and events we started talking about in our first episode of this series. The asylum system, as you're about to find out, is pretty complex and can be a little convoluted, so we tried our best to keep it as clear as possible while also being transparent about some of the complexities involved. This is a really important episode for thinking about relational considerations, kind of common experiences those families might have. There are certainly important nuances of the asylum system for social workers to understand as we work with folks who themselves are trying to navigate this system for their family. So, without further ado, Sarah, thank you for being here with me. I'd like to start by having you introduce yourself, talk about your prior professional experience and relationship to the work.
Sure. So my name is Sarah Brennis. I'm the executive director of the Binger Center for New Americans. We're a center that's housed within the law clinics, within the law school at the University of Minnesota. But we're also born out of and rooted in our broader legal services community, our legal service providers. There's three legal service providers that we provide financial support to and work to train students to join as part of the immigration legal advocacy community, as well as three law firms that have had commitments to doing pro bono work in immigration law. I started at the law school in August of 2022. And prior to that, I was the director of the Refugee and Immigrant Program at the Advocates for Human Rights. And I worked there for over a decade, primarily providing legal services to asylum seekers, human trafficking survivors, unaccompanied children, immigrants in immigration detention, largely through volunteers. A lot of attorneys who did not practice immigration law as their primary area of practice. Those that did are often, or that do, are often mentors. But a lot of times they're attorneys getting their start, attorneys that are working at law firms and donating their time to help provide services, legal services, to individuals who can't otherwise afford a private attorney. I also kind of have bookended my career in working in the law school setting. I graduated from the University of St. Thomas Law School and worked there for 3 years as a clinical law fellow and supervised law students who were primarily in that case as well, working with asylum seekers. And in that case, a lot of times preparing students on one or two cases and really going in depth, preparing for asylum interviews, hearings before the immigration court, where now I also supervise a clinic called the Rural Immigrant Access Clinic, and we really work more on the front end, so providing services through consultations and brief services for people who are just arriving and navigating the asylum process. So have kind of been in all ranges of the procedural posture for asylum seekers, but it's been certainly part of my career for the over 15 years that I practiced immigration law, and prior to going to law school, worked with an immigration attorney who represented a lot of asylum seekers. That is largely what inspired me to go to law school and pursue a career in immigration law.
Fantastic. So for those who are less familiar, can we just start with the basics? What is asylum? What's it for? Maybe talk a little bit about some of the history of asylum in the U.S.
Asylum as an immigration benefit really is what it is rooted in the lessons learned after World War II. There's a refugee convention that really inspires a lot of the substance of what our refugee law and then what became domestic law in our asylum law here in the United States is really rooted in the premise that it is a protection for individuals who have a well-founded fear of persecution, which is essentially defined as being really life-threatening harm that they might suffer if they go back to their country of origin. And it has to be connected to one of what we call the five protected grounds. So race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. I think the quintessential asylum claim has largely been political opinion claims where individuals may have been harmed, threatened, tortured by the government of their country because of political activity, oftentimes when individuals are trying to stand up against regimes and governments that are not protecting human rights in their country. So we've seen many asylum seekers from a lot of different countries. I think in Minnesota, we have a large population of individuals from Ethiopia. Ethiopia has had a long track record of human rights abuses and torture for people that oppose the government. We've also seen the conflict in Cameroon has forced a lot of people to flee, particularly Anglophones in that country, as well as the Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, and in some cases, individuals are able to access their refugee system and they might be resettled here in the United States. And when we're talking about individuals in the United States, that is refugee resettlement through our resettlement agencies that work with folks who come in with refugee status and have access to some more expansive than others, but still limited in time in terms of support to help find housing and jobs and are on a path to permanent status here in the United States. For asylum seekers, oftentimes it might be individuals who have had a quicker path. I mean, actually, a lot of times we see asylum seekers are kind of at the front end of a refugee wave because people are coming in through as students, they're able to get visitor visas, they're coming in through some other legal path and then apply for asylum. And so sometimes that's kind of the canary in the coal mine with a lot of waves, especially when things, I would say prior to kind of real-time media, we would see that kind of as a front-end trend and then start to see refugee resettlement. I think over the past, you know, more than a decade, we've started to see what's actually a second wave. We can go back even further in history to look at the 80s and 90s and the conflicts in Central America and how there were large waves of asylum seekers and the United States approved less than 5% of those applications. But we're starting to see, and what we've seen in higher numbers are people arriving at the southern border and requesting asylum there, some Central South American, but other people who've come from other countries in Africa and China and other places and are making their way by land to seek protection here in the US.
Admittedly, this next question is asking you to condense a lot of things, but if I can be so bold, can you say a bit about a typical asylum claim and what the process has looked like for folks?
I would say there's four paths to maybe being recognized as a refugee, we'll say that. So the first is refugee resettlement, people coming in, they've gone through a legal process abroad and they come in with refugee status. Next are people who are applying affirmatively for asylum. And that might be people who came in with a status. They might still be in that status when they're pursuing asylum. We see that sometimes with students. They may have fallen out of status or they've entered without any status, were undetected, but are affirmatively applying with the asylum office. for asylum. There's an extremely long backlog in those cases. Right now, they're prioritizing applications for Afghans, most of whom were evacuated. Congress didn't pass an adjustment act, and so many are going through the asylum process to really have an individualized assessment of their fear of going back to Afghanistan right now. And so a lot of those cases are prioritized and everything else. And there was a backlog before the Afghans were prioritized. So everything else is really put on the back burner. So very slow process for affirmative asylum. And then there's two other categories that are considered defensive asylum applications. And those are for individuals who might already be in the United States and are encountered by Immigration Custom Enforcement, placed in removal proceedings. And if they're found to be removable from the United States, they can ask for asylum. And there are some corollary benefits, withholding of removal and Convention Against Torture Relief. It's all the same paper form application for three different categories under immigration law, but they can seek those protections as a defense and an immigration benefit when they're before the immigration judge. And then finally, those that are seeking asylum when they arrive in the United States. And I think that seems to be the group that you're most focused on here in this podcast. But individuals who arrive at our southern border are subject to what's called expedited removal. That was a law passed in the mid-90s that really was a border enforcement tool and intended to turn away people from gaining access to the United States unless they expressed a well-founded fear of persecution, a credible fear. So the standards, they have to show that they had a credible fear of persecution. There's been a lot of inconsistency in how things are being handled at the border for a variety of reasons, but the by the books method is typically people are subject to immigration detention if they express a credible fear, and then they have what's really kind of a mini asylum interview with an asylum officer to talk about their case. There have been a few different proposals and actual changes in how those credible fear interviews are being processed and the power that the asylum officer has. But typically it's intended to be a lower threshold to see, does someone have a credible fear based on their testimony alone? Because rarely do people have evidence that they can present during these interviews. And then if they do establish a credible fear, they are eligible to be considered for parole, which physically allows them to enter the United States, but then they're referred to an immigration judge for what's called 240 proceedings, which is the statute under the Immigration Nationality Act, where then they can subsequently file that full application for asylum and present evidence at the hearings that they might have after that.
All right, listeners, before we get into a little more on those hearings, I want to circle back to that backlog Sarah referenced. The American Immigration Council reports that nationally for 2023, there were more than 105,000 affirmative asylum cases and more than 782,000 defensive asylum applications waiting to be processed. Further, the wait time for individuals who were eventually granted asylum was as long as 1,364 days on average in Virginia, which had the longest 2023 backlog wait time compared to other states. Track Reports, which is an online tool we'll link below, that keeps track of wait times and number of completed cases each year by state, reports that for Minnesota in 2023, the average wait time for an approval, so for cases that were approved as eligible for asylum, was 828 days. That's a little over 2 years and 3 months of waiting with a credible claim to see whether or not your claim will be granted. As a way to improve our understanding of what this waiting process can look like and what these hearings entail, I'm now going to kick it back to Sarah to talk for a few minutes about the hearings process.
There's basically two types of hearings in immigration court. One's called the master calendar hearing. The other is the individual or merits hearing. And someone might have a few master calendar hearings. If they hire an attorney before having any hearings, they might not have any master calendar hearings that are really intended to be kind of scheduling preliminary hearings. It's usually a room full of people scheduled for hearing at the same time and don't really talk about the substance of the claim, but can indicate that they're applying for asylum, have some short conversations with the judge, confirm their address, and then be set for a final hearing. which could be a few months from then, or it could be a few years, depending on the court's docket. And then at that individual hearing would have a chance to testify, could present witnesses. And I think of growing importance is the documentation that individuals present to support that claim. You know, the immigration judges are under a lot of pressure to process many, many cases as quickly as possible. And so the consequence of that is usually shorter hearings, for better, for worse, for people to present oral testimony or have live witnesses that are available. So really making sure that the claim is well documented becomes very important to really frame the case and give the individual their best chance to be granted asylum.
Yeah. Well, and if you're relying on a witness, I imagine 3 months versus 3 years could make a really big difference in terms of being able to provide that. So I think that really articulates some of the prolonged precarity and like some of the very active waiting that these families are doing.
I think I'd also just say, you know, for the witnesses and really for the applicants, because it's a lot of information to be forced to retain. And it's information, I mean, a lot of times it's the worst thing that happened in your life that you have to remember in great detail to be able to tell a judge. And that's a lot of pressure to remember that. And it's a lot of strain on one's mental health to have to retain that information when they're simultaneously trying to make a life, support children, you know, move on and move through what they had survived. And they're just really stagnated when they don't have that hearing in a timely manner to help them figure out what's next.
Wow. Yeah. Can you say a little bit more about sort of how there's so much flux in the speed and the steps of the process for people and how that's changed kind of over recent years?
The processing of cases has never been a transparent process by the government. Really, it's sort of been whatever the current administration's priority is put to the front of the line. You know, there was a time where before the Afghans, it was the unaccompanied children, because there's actually a caveat to the defense of asylum process for unaccompanied children. So children who arrive in the United States under the age of 18 without a parent are able to have their claim heard by the asylum office before going to the immigration court. And so for a time, the asylum office was prioritizing unaccompanied children, and they were being scheduled very quickly, which can be really hard, I think, for kids going through the process on their own, because it takes a long time for adults to build trust with those who may be trying to help them through the process, and even more for kids. We've seen cases where a child did not prevail before the asylum office, but by the time they had their hearing before the immigration judge, they had built trust and rapport with their attorney, and they were able to present that claim that was really a lot deeper in their trauma histories. So I think what we've been seeing more of is delays and, you know, loss of urgency from the court. It takes pressure off having to prioritize their claim, but then it also makes it harder to gather evidence later on. So someone might come in, have a master calendar hearing, and then have another one scheduled. And, you know, between the court increased docket, we had at one point, the court was so overburdened that they just put thousands of cases in a placeholder that was, I think it was November 29, 2019, maybe. It was like the day after Thanksgiving in a specific year. And they just sort of put all these cases there and not thinking those hearings were actually going to happen, that they were going to get rescheduled, that the court had more judges, more funding. That was kind of one of the ways that they tried to address it. And then folks were scheduled for, you know, early 2020. And then all those cases got removed from the docket during COVID, and then trying to figure out if remote hearings could happen. The technology barriers were really challenging for people. I think a silver lining during COVID was courts being more open and available for people to appear remotely, because before you'd file a motion to appear telephonically. We had clients in the like 2015, when there was the first wave of families arriving, they were on a really prioritized Rocket Docket schedule. It was every 2 or 3 weeks they had a master calendar hearing. And people weren't all located near the court. We had people paying $400 or $500 for a ride from central southwest Minnesota because the judge said they had to be there. So instead of paying for that month's groceries, they were paying to drive 3-4 hours to appear for a 5 to 10 minute hearing.
Sarah shared a number of anecdotes highlighting how disruptive this unclear and often protracted process is and how that can impact people's lives and relationships.
I had a client, the client had a spouse and children back in their country of origin. And the client told me that their spouse no longer believed that they were actually pursuing asylum because they kept telling them they had these asylum hearings and they didn't happen. I mean, it had a strain on this family that was really trying to reunite based on the safety that one of their family members needed. So I think that's another really frustrating process. We also had people that they had a hearing scheduled and then the court moved it up by 3 or 4 weeks, but the person didn't get the notice until the hearing had already happened. And then they had an in absentia order that they had to deal with. So the unpredictability and lack of transparency with the scheduling process itself has been a whole nother layer of stress for people who are just trying to move forward in the process and have their day in court. We also had someone who drove from Minnesota to Indiana for a check-in because no one answered the phone or returned the email when they were trying to explain that they're now in Minnesota. Can they just go to the office here? So I think there's a lot of examples of people really trying to do their best to comply with rules that just keep changing beneath them. And I think that's it creates a lot of confusion. I mean, even we as attorneys, because it's not by the book. So it's really hard to help people navigate and understand, much less, you know, a lot of the community groups that are trying to support people really in those initial stages of figuring out how to get things started has been kind of just as challenging as substantiating the substantive claim. And all these things have nothing to do with the actual claim for asylum.
So given how taxing this process is with the lack of security and the uncertainty and the protracted waiting, I asked Sarah to talk about what the rest of life looks like for people and families who are navigating this process.
The rest of life is very much up in the air for a lot of families. In the United States, where you relatively unique in that asylum seekers are neither provided with any sort of social safety net by the federal government or provide immediate access to work authorization. A lot of that was rooted in suspicions of abuse of the system when legitimate asylum seekers were coming from Central America in the 80s and 90s, that they created a rule that establishes a waiting period for individuals to file for work authorization, having to wait 5 months to even to apply for a work permit and aren't eligible to get one until 6 months after they've submitted their asylum claim. There were proposals under the prior administration to increase that up to 365 days, but that didn't hold up in court. So we're back to 150 days. So if you file it at 145 days, you might be denied because you don't hit 180 by the time they process it. But it does make it difficult for people to get credentials to be able to work with authorization.
Yeah. So given the limits of like authorization to work, can you talk a little about like how asylum seekers are unique in terms of eligibility for things like benefits?
You know, it's really kind of state, county, local government specific on any sort of support individuals might get while they're waiting prior to or even after they get work authorization, because I think many asylum seekers tend to have success in getting some of the lower paying jobs. A lot of people, due to language barriers or credentials for foreign certifications, are underemployed in the process of seeking asylum. But there's some benefits. You know, Minnesota is unique from other states and some of the services it allows parolees to access. So there's some local benefits, but a lot of that really depends on your county workers understanding the nuance of it all. Maybe you're eligible because you were given parole when you were released from immigration custody, but not everyone is. Some people are given their notice to appear and are never held in detention or given that parole document and are unaware that they even have parole. And then having the paperwork that shows that they filed their asylum claim in immigration court is actually a two-step process that you have to submit your full claim to the immigration court, but then you have to file a few pages of the application with the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service that will process your biometrics, your fingerprinting, and they send you a receipt, but the court doesn't give you a receipt. You can bring your copy and get it stamped or check the phone line. But in terms of having evidence that you, the date that you filed your claim, it's really, you have to navigate that knowledge on your own. It's not really automatic. So there's a lot of reliance on the community support, whether it be organized community groups, individuals opening their homes. We've worked with a lot of faith communities that have different programs for asylum seekers to help pay for a few months' rent or, you know, arrange for transportation help, kind of navigating what people need at a certain point of time. And then, you know, really a great deal of communities that are helping each other and lots of couch surfing and families taking in other families and, you know, risking having issues with their own landlords because they're over capacity in their unit because their neighbor needed a place to sleep. A lot of that is commendable in terms of the generosity, frustrating on the part of the limitations from the government, and really a lot of extra stress for asylum seekers to try to figure out, how do you not outstay your welcome with someone who took you in? How do you navigate getting authorization to work and then the whole other burden of finding a job in a new country while you're still trying to navigate getting to your immigration court hearings and meeting with your lawyer? And, you know, for a lot of jobs, it's not really forgiving to get time off for those sort of things too. So that's another piece that can be really challenging. And then those with children, obviously, trying to navigate how to get kids into school, navigate a whole different cultural system and expectations of your involvement in school, or how and where kids need to be in order to make sure your kids really feel that they're welcomed and getting the support that they need in this new place as well.
Sarah and I also discussed the influence of recent politics on families' willingness to access the benefits that they are eligible for.
Under the prior administration, there were certain penalties proposed and expanded on, you know, people accessing public benefits. And that is another 1980s, 1990s era reform that blamed immigrants for, you know, being a burden on the welfare states. And so there are all these additional restrictions on gaining lawful status in the United States if you had access any certain benefits, and more restrictions on what people could access. So those are still on the books. And then there were proposals to make it graver consequences for that. And I think that regardless of the fact that those aren't in place right now, there is a legitimate fear that people have that, especially if there's some sort of look back later. And then when you think about the types of benefits that are available in the layers at the federal level, the state level, the county level, and one might trigger, the other might not. I mean, when I have worked with clients, I just say, you know, this is your status right now. Here's the paper that proves it. Bring it to the county and tell them that's what it is. What am I eligible for? And, you know, it's their job to know and navigate and not have you apply for a federal benefit if you're not eligible, but do help you access some of the things that you are eligible for. So I think that's, you know, one of the real challenges, and especially an understandable concern for a lot of the case managers and caseworkers that want to do right by the individual. They want to help them access as much as they can, but they also don't want to undermine their future ability to be able to stay in the U.S. because, you know, in all things immigration, the burden's on the applicant to show that you didn't do something that would jeopardize your ability to be eligible, or that you did suffer enough to be considered worthy of an asylum grant. So I think that there's certainly not much of a benefit of the doubt when both parties, when you think about those applications for public benefits, are really, you know, have the best intentions and don't want to access things they're not eligible for, but certainly could use the help if they are.
Yeah. So given all of these complications, I'm tempted to ask, like, how do you approach the work, or what advice do you have for how to approach this work?
I think it's really important to remember and to remind ourselves and clients that we're providing a service to individuals who are coming with tools in their toolbox, and they're in a new place and they need some new and different tools. You know, once you get in a rhythm and you know how something works, it's very easy to just do it. But really trying to figure out how do you teach someone to fish and, you know, navigate the waters for the first time? That's really hard. So I think that's a really important thing to be mindful of. And it's great that we have people who are experts in navigating this. And then, you know, I think the expertise in figuring out how to explain it, as we as lawyers are realizing there are not enough of us it would be great to really, let's try to get universal representation. Everyone has an attorney, but that's actually probably not going to be enough because we don't have enough attorneys to hire to help everyone right now. And so a lot of people are going to have to navigate it alone. And, you know, we're used to coming in and doing the work and representing people, but really what's needed is having more people have tools so that they can navigate at least some of it on their own with a little more confidence. So, it sounds like in the social work field, there's still a lot of work to do for people to understand the ins and outs of the bridge between immigration and some of the public benefits. But, you know, it's a great chance to early on really focus on those tools that are accessible in multiple languages, multiple literacy levels, so that people can gain that information themselves and really be engaged in the process rather than riding along on what may be their future.
Sarah also talked about the importance of taking accountability for the work that's within the sphere of your job, but also knowing that there are going to be parts of this process that we aren't and can't be accountable for.
There's a lot of systemic barriers, so helping people navigate them, see what they are. You know, I remember talking with clients who are from African countries and just like the eye-opening experience of walking down the street and realizing I might need my roommate who's white to walk down the street with me because I don't feel safe otherwise. And I don't know why. And just like encountering the racism that exists in our country is new for people. So I think some of those spaces of finding trust to be able to help folks navigate those things, realizing that we're a tool in the toolbox to help them move forward, and not over owning and patronizing people by thinking that we're going to solve all their problems because we're not, but really taking ownership of the piece that we can own and the expertise that we do have, and do our best to make sure that it's clear and understandable to clients who are new to it.
Finally, Sarah talked about the importance of remembering how your sphere of influence interacts with other professions and systems of support, and the essential role of cross-sector collaboration, as we also saw in our discussions from episode one.
Remembering that we're just a part of the puzzle. You know, I think it's phenomenal when I see cases that finish and then am invited to an event where a client is appreciating all the people that help them along the way. And I'm not the only one. That room is full of people who have stepped up and have provided, you know, some assistance of, you know, getting on the phone and using their English to help them schedule an appointment that they tried three times with interpreting work or whatever, helping enroll kids in school, you know, helping navigate the asylum process. Like the list is endless of things that people need. And families are also very resourceful in figuring out what pieces that they need. They know, you know, what their immediate needs are. They might not know those other layers in the process. So finding that, what is that immediate thing that the individual needs? And I think also really being really specific. I remember when we were starting a screening process and we were working on with some partners to do some accompaniment work. And we were finding that we would ask clients, you know, are you getting enough food? And they would say yes. And then we'd say, how many meals do you eat a day? And they'd say one. And then we'd realize, oh, well, maybe we need to be more specific, because a lot of times clients, their default is no one's going to help me. I got to figure it out on my own. And there's a real reluctance to have to depend on others. So I think that empowerment to help people know that we're here to provide a service and you should feel free to use us as a service.
Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me and provide this look into how this process can play out for families and do a little brainstorming to think about how social workers can be good collaborators and help support families as they navigate this process. I so appreciate you taking the time. Have a great rest of the day.
Thanks, you too.
That concludes our conversation with Sarah Brennus about the process of asylum for families who apply. Our final installment of the series will focus on direct social work practice considerations. So joining with families, creating a safe relationship, how social workers can support our newcomer neighbors who are coming to Minnesota to make a better life for their family through asylum. Thank you all for your time and attention today. Please remember to peruse the episode notes below for some additional resources, both national and local, that you might want if you end up working with a family who's navigating asylum. And please keep a lookout for our next episode. Bye.
This podcast was supported in part by a grant from the Minnesota Department of Human Services, Children and Family Services Division.